Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this. It is, well, something completely different from the Egg Chasers. I'm JB, released from my normal job at Beardmore & Co. Independent Financial Advisors to experiment with a different type of content. Now, before we get into this, just remember we do Egg Chasers. This will be on the Egg Chasers feed, so you know all about that. And if you've got even more spare time on even more excellent rugby content, go see Tim Cocker over on his YouTube show. However, what we're going to talk about today is the business of rugby. And to help me navigate these choppy waters, I'm with the guru of rugby business himself, Mark Evans. How are you, Mark?
Very unguru-like. But other than that, very well indeed. Thank you.
Now, of course, like all good gurus, you're on your island. Where are you now? What have you been doing today?
I am in Viti Levu, which is the main island of Fiji. I'm in the northwest near Nandi, between Nandi and the airport, which is where I live, 9 months of the year. And what have I done today? Oh, I don't know. Trying to finish off our 2025 list, player list, that is.
So
nearly done with that.
Just an interesting point there. You've called that a player list. And I like that because that's more like Australian terminology. What you're saying is you're playing squad.
Yeah, good point. Yes, I suppose I've been here in other guises. And, yeah, list management, that's what it comes from, which is, I think, probably an American phrase by origin, but it's sort of become shorthand for, your squad management. And in some cases, obviously, not in Fiji at the moment, salary cap. We have more of a budget cap than a salary cap, it must be said. How big your squad, and do you have a self-imposed minimum wage, which we do. So we have all those sorts of things. So we're working, myself and the general manager, who really run the list, not the coaches. Mm. They have an input, but that's a separation of power was there. We're putting the finishing touches to our 2025 roster. There's another American expression.
There we go. Well, I think there's plenty to get into on Fijian rugby franchises and lists shortly. But I think we're going to open up with this, which is there's been a story circulating quite widely at the moment. We all know that rugby's finances are not in the best place. And it feels like they might have a white knight of some sort in Saudi sovereign wealth money. Now, this is pretty contentious. I mean, I think it's contentious for everybody who's not a Newcastle United fan. Where do you stand on it, Mark?
Probably in a rather uncomfortable position, I think. The easy thing to do for somebody of a lefty liberal progressive such as myself, a bit like you, JB, really,
exactly
course.
Like me,
exactly mirror image, is to get on your moral high horse and to cry it from the rooftops. And I do think, however, there is something in there. I think there's no doubt you look at the motivation of the Saudi government. Sport plays a big part in what they are trying to do in what they call Vision 2030, a $7 trillion project to diversify away from fossil fuels. It's the sort of Dubai on steroids, I think, is quite a good way of thinking of
it. It's very much that, isn't it?
The difference being that Saudi has an awful lot of oil and Dubai had none. It was all next door in Abu Dhabi, their fellow emirate. So the incentive for the Dubai royal family was many, many, you know, many years ago was much more direct. But sport, you know, this phrase sports washing is thrown about.
Do you actually know what sports washing is? Because I don't, I'm not even familiar with what the term is meant to represent.
Yeah, it's a phrase used to describe what a lot of governments do, both democratic and autocracies and monarchies, which is Saudi, of course, whereby they use events, sporting and other, to burnish the image of the country on the global stage. It's not that different from why do you want to host a Grand Prix?
Or yes.
Why do cities bid for the Olympics? I mean, if you want an example, or sometimes, you know, it's like all these things. It's on a continuum. I mean, it goes from announcing yourself to the world. I mean, the Beijing Games were a really good example of that in 2008, wasn't it? It was like a global coming out party. We've arrived as a major economic global power, and how better to announce your arrival than through the biggest show on earth? Is that sports washing or is that soft power?
It's a good point, isn't it? There's also a third element of this as well, which is, I don't think this does apply to rugby, but it certainly does with the big sporting events. If you want a World Cup, if you want a global event, a truly global event, you have to have hosts that you find pretty abhorrent because it's a global event. It is not the democratic Olympic Games. It's not the Human Rights World Cup. It is the World Cup. So it either is or it isn't.
Well, I mean, this is interesting, isn't it? Because Saudi, I think, are the only bidder for the 2034 Football World Cup.
Yeah.
I think I'm correct in saying that. And it looks like we're heading for another European Winter World Cup in football. And it's all part of the same thing. I mean, most of Saudi money investment in sport is done through the same vehicle. And it's to now been not entirely focused on football. Football has been the biggest. Not just Newcastle United, the amount of money gone into the Saudi domestic league has been significant.
Yeah.
But WWE had done a 10-year deal with the Saudi government, as I understand it. Two things can be true at the same time, can't they? I do think some of the changes in Saudi Arabia in recent years have been, you know, promising. At the same token, by Western standards, their human rights record is pretty abhorrent. 81 mass execution in March 22, pretty recently, is difficult for many people to stomach. Where do you stand on this? Well, do you see Saudi Arabia as, you know, a long way from a democracy, but a bulwark against Islamism? You could argue that.
Yeah.
It's a really, really difficult one. My problem with it is actually, and I do have a problem with it. But it isn't quite so much the moral dilemma, although I do understand that is the case, and I do share some of those concerns. But I don't think it'll fix it. And I've said this many, many times, and I will keep saying it. Doesn't fix the model injecting another. People are talking about 60 million. I saw. I don't know if that's true. I have no idea. But let's say it is, just for argument's sake. That 60 million gets injected into four clubs for 15 million apiece for an equity stake.
Yeah.
Presumably in clubs. And therefore, slightly different to the CVC deal, which was a 28% linked to central revenues, largely broadcast, basically. When you invest in individual clubs, it doesn't matter whether you're Saudi or whether you're American or whether you're from, rural Northampton, like Keith Barwell was.
Yeah.
You're not getting a claim on, you're buying a share of all of an individual business that is largely loss-making.
Yeah.
So there are unlikely to be any dividends or share in or shares of income streams in the very short run. So my question is this. Why is this any different than Nigel Ray pumping 60 million, which he has done, into Saracens?
It's a great question, isn't it?
In the sense that that didn't fix the model either.
No, it didn't. Now, I would argue...
So I'm bemused, actually, about why you would do this until the model changed.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue... I mean, the reason you do this, you buy into rugby, it can't be for money. It simply can't be. Nigel Ray said it. Simon Orange has said it. You don't get rich through buying into rugby. In fact, I had a very interesting conversation with Simon Orange, and he said that the best thing he can do for his rugby club is continue to work in his other business, because putting his mind and thought into running of Sale Sharks just isn't worth his time. I mean, that's not the right way to say it. It's not that it's not worth his time, but it's his other businesses that will support Sale Sharks. That's the best thing that he can do for rugby. So it's not to make money. Now, it may
sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, sure.
Chebby, I think you've got to be careful you're not a bit Anglo-centric there. And I know that this is Saudi Arabian possible money investing into the English Premiership. So to a degree, I understand that. But, there are examples of people making money from rugby investments around the world.
Oh,
I mean, would you say, for example, and I think this is a really interesting question, why are ye English clubs and not French?
Yeah, great. Well, that is a good question. I would say the reason you'd look at English rugby is, it's not for making profit, but the one thing English rugby has, and it still has, is outsized cultural significance. So if you want to oil the wheels of commerce from a Saudi point of view, having something which is regularly reported on the press. Now, we were talking the other day, actually, that there's not much in the way of rugby reporting, as in the actual physical size of the journalism teams in each paper, but they are still there. They are still there, and it's a much smaller sport than many others with a lot of participation, whether that be cycling or something else, and it gets daily coverage. So I think, actually, in terms of what can rugby offer someone, it would be one of two things. It would be the ability, much like Saudis have racehorses now, to get people in to network and meet and all those sort of connection things. Or it's an outsized cultural influence, because I think both of those are very valuable.
Well, if you take what a lot of the Saudi ministers say at face value, and sometimes you can on certain topics. I mean, I'm not naive, but on certain topics, I think you can. They would one of the hoped for byproducts of this investment in sport is more people going to Saudi Arabia.
Yes, quite.
More people being interested, having some kind of link, and actually going and experiencing the country. Now, that's very interesting, because that again is the Dubai model, isn't it?
Yes.
Dubai has become, I mean, frankly, on a personal level, not my cup of tea.
So on a personal level, I love it. I absolutely love it.
Yes, I'm not surprised. Yeah. Anyway, and you're probably not surprised that I'm slightly,
I am. Look, when it comes to these things, I'm a pure hedonist. I love Dubai. And I think just looking at the Saudi thing, the underlying you know, the underlying thing which will get people to go and visit a country which isn't currently very, very much fun, like Saudi is to make it fun. And I think Dubai has done that wonderfully. It is good fun.
Events are fun. Because, let's be fair, we're going to get very, very in the weeds now. I apologise. Pull me back if I look like I'm going to get marooned. You also have to understand Saudi Arabia is not the Emirates. And the influence of the Wahhabi strain of Islam in Saudi Arabia is much, much more significant. It's much more conservative, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Which the optimists would say, and that's why they're doing this. One of the reasons they're doing the sport thing to liberalize a very, very conservative civic society. I don't know. That's why I'm not absolutely screaming up and down and saying, no, this is terrible. This is awful. I can't. You know, I don't know if that's true or not. But you know, some of the events that are planned, boxing looks like it's about to have some quite major events in Saudi Arabia.
I think UFC
WWE
has.
Definitely will.
Yeah.
Definitely will. Football, you know, I don't know. Look at the Chinese experience of trying to establish a national football league. It has been with billions and billions of dollars. It's been a disaster.
Yeah.
It's not easy. It doesn't necessarily mean that it'll be successful. So, I'm very cautious about it because I didn't quite finish my main point, which is typical of me. We've pumped an awful lot of money into the Premiership and it hasn't fixed it.
Yes.
Why do we suddenly think more money from a different nation will fix it? And I'm very, very dubious. If we don't change a whole lot of other things about the Premiership, it'll just be, and you think you've heard me say this a number of times, I certainly have written it a number of times, you know, increasing revenue over time has not been the Premiership's problem.
Now, to quote you on this,
they've actually done a pretty good job of it.
Now, to quote you on this, one of my favorite stories is when you told me when you we were recounting a meeting with some of the other Premiership hierarchy, and they claimed if only we had £1 million a year, we would be sustainable.
1999, Tom Walkinshaw, round a board table, everybody agreed that if only we get £1 million of central funding, we'd all be profitable within 2 years. Those were the days. There you go.
How did that work out?
So
just on the, I mean, we don't really want to go into changing of the governance too much because I think that is a whole podcast in of itself.
A completely different can of worms.
But I do tend to agree with you there. I mean, it depends on the investment of the Saudi money, I guess, and how sustainable that is. And it does feel like a Saudi sovereign wealth fund is less susceptible to investor fatigue than, say, the local carpet warehouse owner.
Question about that. No question. But there is one other problem which I'm not sure can be resolved, which is more of a sporting integrity issue.
Oh, go on.
If four clubs are going to have significant shareholders from the same sovereign wealth fund, I think we might have a problem.
I tend to agree with that.
Sporting integrity. You know, you can't. Do you remember? Maybe you don't. But do you remember when, now who was it? Was it Altrad came and wanted to buy a slice of Gloucester?
Yeah, he's already got Montpellier, hasn't he? And I think he has his name on the French shirts.
And the All Black shirts.
Oh, now, that's the one,
No, both. All Blacks and France.
Okay.
And it was ruled that that was a conflict of interest and that obviously the worry, therefore, is if this goes in football, goes all the way back to Robert Maxwell, Derby County. No, was it Derby County and Oxford United? I think back.
Crikey.
You know, back in the day, and he, you know, has turned out the pension raiding Robert Maxwell.
Yep.
Ended up was trying to basically own two football clubs, and it was when it was pointed out that perhaps this might be a problem if they were drawn against each other in the FA Cup with all the kinds of sort of possibilities of match fixing and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are reasons why you can't own more than one team in a competition, and they're very good reasons.
I think I'd let Saudis own all of the clubs, but I don't think I'd let them own four clubs.
Well, why, interesting, isn't it? CVC went to buy the league, which, whatever your views on CVC and
did they really? What, like, as in the whole league?
Well, you're not buying them. I mean, they don't own a slice of the 12 clubs, do they? They have a claim on the central.
Yeah. I mean, the way I look at that is it's a very clever type of derivative in a way. You know, you get equity-like returns and bond-like security.
Well, I'm not sure they felt like that when Wasps and Worcester and Jersey and London Irish went under, because, I mean, that was always the big risk when you involve you are hedging your risk, but when you are buying into a league, you are taking on the risk of, they always used to say, the league's as strong as its weakest link.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's probably true. But I still think, whatever you think about the CBC deal, and that's another podcast, I do understand why they bought into the league as opposed to individual clubs.
Absolutely.
As well as the integrity issue is a problem, yeah. Anyway, so maybe it was partly that.
The reason you don't want a club is you don't want the expenses. Simple as that. That's why it's so clever.
You don't want exposure to the cost risk, no. Of course. So why would the Saudis, who are not, you know, they're not unsophisticated investors, are they? I expect they probably think, well, would the clubs give away another slice of central revenue? Almost certainly not, one would hope.
Yep.
So why don't they, you know, South Africa's still up for grabs.
I think
that CBC deal hasn't gone through. The French are very anti-private equity. It's really interesting. They call it Anglo-Saxon finance.
They might,
and
yeah.
They're not big fans.
And I bet they say that with a derogatory tone as well.
Well, I think it depends on which part of the country, but, you know, whatever.
But just on that, I think the reason for that is dead simple. The CVC deal is CVC plough a lot of money into getting very clever people to come up with innovative schemes. It didn't have to be rugby. It could have been anything. It could have been, you know, the uplift on the value of land. It could have been carbon credits. It could have been absolutely anything. That's what they pay these guys to do. They pay out. They pay them to go and invent clever things. And they just saw a distress sport, and they need a certain amount of money for their hurdle rate in the Series 7 fund. And that's what they did. They have no interest in rugby whatsoever.
Well, yeah,
whereas the Saudis do.
It wasn't their first sports investment. And, you know, PE in sport at the moment, not just in rugby and not just in the UK, is undoubtedly a growing market. We are digressing a little bit, I suppose, but it's interesting. I think I read the other day that the NFL, for the first time, are going to allow private equity investment.
That's crazy.
So let's look a little bit broader here and say, look, it's interesting. Some people turn it down. Australian rugby, for many, many months, years, we're talking about private equity investment. And in the end, either because they couldn't find anyone, or they couldn't find anyone who would offer them what they felt to be reasonable terms, they went down the debt path rather than the private equity path. Now, as I understand it, the interest rate on that debt is pretty challenging.
Goodness.
So we'll see how that ends up. But the private equity is a real thing in most sports around the world now. It's up for consideration. Let's put it that way, and that's just the way it is.
Now, just taking this Saudi money conversation in a slightly different direction, I'd love to know your view on this. The attitude towards this in the media and, you know, on things, online platforms such as Twitter, is overwhelmingly negative. Do you see this as just another way of rugby being so moralistic it just shoots itself in the foot? Because in my mind, I
you think it is, don't you?
Absolutely.
Is this going to be one of your, the values of rugby aren't worth the paper they're not written on?
It's not even that. I just think the sheer hypocrisy of it. You've got to turn on the lights. You've got to use your plastic gizmos. We use oil products in basically everything that we do. And the argument against Saudi oil money would be, well, we don't want them. We don't want to use dirty oil profits whilst every day using all the things which create them a profit. And if you were to believe what Vision 2030 is, it's to do exactly what we want them to do, if you do want them to do that, which is decarbonize. They want to get away from oil.
I think the human rights record rather than the fossil fuel argument, although I do accept there may be some overlap between the critics of both. But I do feel it should and does make you stop and pause, but it should make you stop and pause and then do some reading and try and make a balanced judgment rather than simply dismissing it out of court. There are, because you do have to draw the line somewhere. I think it's a question of where. I mean, what would you say to North Korea?
How much are they paying me?
Is that okay?
It's unlikely, but
purely as a theoretical argument, is that okay? And or would you say that, it's highly unlikely, and I'm probably overstating. I'm probably
an Iranian club
going a little bit too far. I'm quite hopeful for Albania. I think
so. Sorry, Iranian.
Well, there we are. There's an interesting one. Would there be a difference? Both oil nations.
Yeah.
The big Sunni power, the big Shia power, one a monarchy, one a theocracy. Yeah, do you draw the line somewhere between those? I don't know. And I do read a fair bit about the sort of Middle East and history and all the rest of it. And it's quite difficult. It's quite easy to be pure as the driven snow when actually I'm going to make the decision, I've always found.
I totally agree with that. Do you know the word? Sorry, Mark.
I don't know. I'm. It does. I mean, probably done it. We probably sort of examined this from a few angles now. It does worry me from a sort of a human rights angle. It does. I think from my personal view is it would come down to whether I genuinely felt warts and all the current Saudi regime were genuinely trying to move in the right direction.
I
think that's where I'd probably draw the line. There are some regimes around the world where I think sanctions and a refusal to trade is an appropriate response. And this is an example of trade. It's capital flows. That's what it is.
The one deal which would really make me stop and think would be the NBA's experience with China. I think this is one which is really important. And obviously China's human rights record is abysmal. I don't know how it actually compares to Saudi Arabia's, although I imagine it is comparable. But the thing which really got me about that deal was the attack on press freedoms. And I think that's actually a far more interesting point, because the NBA had a situation where they weren't allowed to criticise anything Chinese. And I guess that does link in.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
into the link into the human rights stuff, because you have this league that wants to talk in the same way that Premiership Rugby does about all these social issues, and then China would say, no, absolutely not, and you certainly can't mention anything about Chinese issues. So they're happy to, the NBA would be happy to attack American culture, but they'd have nothing to say about Uyghur Muslims. They'd have nothing to say, and it just causes so much friction in that domestic market that, hang on, you are making your money here, you're willing to attack us for, you know, all of these different things, yet you're not willing to say a thing to your big economic backer. And I think that's a real danger.
Well, I think if any, you look outside sport, I mean, there are any number of large global companies that have adjusted, shall we say,
very much so,
the requirements you have to make to trade on any kind of scale with China.
Yeah.
And you've only got to look at the, I mean, Google are a good example. I've lost track of it, whether they've now withdrawn or whether they're still, whatever. But they were, that was, look, these things are complicated and nuanced, and they pose moral quandaries, and rugby has to wrestle with them like everybody else.
So Saudi Arabia offer you a check for, what did we say, 60 million? Say one quarter of that for Fiji Drura? What are you going to say?
I'd recommend that we passed, but it would be my board's decision.
Very good. Talking of Fiji Drura, I think we might just move on to that.
So, see what you did there? That's a segue, isn't it?
It is a segue. I learned that from Tim Cocker.
You learned that from Tim Cocker, didn't you?
I did.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
learn from the best. Right, so Fiji Drura. The interesting part of this for me, I mean, despite the fact it's in Fiji and that in all of itself is interesting, is effectively you've established a brand new franchise. Now, we've seen franchises established. I can't think of many which have been successful outside of the original round. So what I mean by that is, if you look at Australia, would their expansion franchises be successful? Probably not. South Africa, probably not the strongest. Certainly pro rugby, Celtic League, you've seen Borders come and go, you've seen Aroni come and go. We've seen lots of franchises come and go. So when you were offered this job, what did you think that the main issues were of starting a franchise, but then keeping a franchise?
Okay. Well, I should point out that I didn't start the franchise. It had been going, it had had one season before I got there.
Yeah.
So credit should go to people like Brian Thorburn and Peter Horn and those, you know, people who were there well before I was. And it took, I'm told, and there's a book coming out, by the way.
Is there?
Written by me, but yes, there will be. It'll be another year or so about the whole birth of the Drua thing. And it was a long time in gestation. It really took a lot. And people had talked about a team on Fiji, oh gosh, 20, 25 years. And it had always felt, it had always been said that it was just not economically viable. The market was too small. And that you just couldn't make the sums add up. And I'll be honest, I sort of bought that. But for many years, I found it very difficult to see how you would get enough revenue to cover some pretty big costs, partly because of location. The travel costs are enormous. Accommodation's pretty expensive. Broadcast was, producing a international standard broadcast in a competition where that's absolutely non-negotiable were really challenging. So what happened, and I don't think you can replicate this necessarily, but it's interesting, is that you basically got a load of funding partners in place that between them were able to create some base capital that you thought, well, all right, if that's all in place, the operational bit might be able to generate enough to make the thing work. So to not be too sort of long-winded about it, the World Rugby put money in, the Australian government put money in.
Why would the Australian government do that?
for the same reason that Saudi Arabia want to invest in sport. It's a form of soft power in geopolitical region.
Well.
To be fair, if we're being less cynical, did that sound a bit cynical? It wasn't meant to. I think it makes an awful lot of sense from an Australian point of view. You know, the South Pacific is geopolitically more and more important with the expansion of the Chinese into the South China Sea. And if you want to win hearts and minds in many of the Pacific islands, rugby union is a very, very good way to do it.
Well,
the same time, don't forget, both Australia and New Zealand have a quite significant diaspora of Pacifica people.
That is true.
Now live in Australia and New Zealand. So Fijians actually not as much as Samoans and Tongans. Fiji is a bigger island. It's got 1 million people. It's twice as big, or 4 times as big as Samoa and 10 times as big as Tonga. Population-wise, so there are more opportunities in Fiji.
Yeah.
So, but nevertheless, Australian government, New Zealand rugby, to give them credit, and they are I do make a distinction. New Zealand rugby, Australian government, we get no money from Rugby Australia. We get no money from the New Zealand government. It's an interesting.
Okay.
But New Zealand rugby genuinely felt a debt to the Pacific nations. I don't think it's virtue signalling or they're just saying it. I genuinely feel they felt it was to help fund Fiji and a Moana Pacifica. I might talk about them later. They were prepared to put some of their broadcast money towards it.
Fair play.
So they should take a lot of credit for that. Now, once you got those three committed, and then the Fiji government came in and didn't provide funding, but provided startup capital. And because of the way the drill went, that was a very good job they did, because otherwise I think we wouldn't have got through the first year. So the Fiji government are the 51% shareholder, and Fiji Rugby Union are the 49% minority shareholder. And Fiji government put in some startup capital, which all startups have to have.
Yep.
You can't create a startup into an established competition without some startup capital, because you're going to lose money early on.
Mm-hmm.
And so once that was in place, then it was really a question of, right, well, okay, well, who are we going to get in? How are we going to run it? Where are we going to get the players from? Where are we going to play? How are we going to do the broadcast? All these million and one things that you need to put together by whenever the first day is.
And what about the facilities? I mean, I don't imagine that Fiji struggles for rugby facilities, but I guess you need a pretty good home base, ground.
Sorry, you wouldn't imagine it does,
imagine it does. I imagine there's plenty of fields gyms and whatnot.
I'm gonna say you've never been to Fiji.
No, never. But I just imagine that, like, you know, there are plenty of rugby fields.
Yeah, no, facilities are a big issue. It's a poor country. It's a poor country.
Well, yeah, but it's a really poor country. I mean, poor countries don't tend to. I mean, I understand if you'd struggled for a rugby field in Manhattan, and that's very rich. So it doesn't necessarily. Chime with me that just because it's poor doesn't have the land available or the pitches available. You've made the point to me in the past, which I really like, that rugby tends to proliferate where it's less built up, like Gloucester.
Yeah, and Fiji is rugby mad. Everybody plays, everybody supports, but the facilities are pretty rudimentary in most areas. Most village kids play on a ploughed up, little more than a ploughed up field or a beach.
Really?
To be honest.
Yeah, a pilot field would be no fun.
So, to come back to the franchise setup.
Yeah.
So, then it was a question of, right, okay, we've got some income committed for a certain amount of time. We've got some startup capital. Right, now, we need some players. And then we need to know where we're going to play and how many grand will we play in. Have we got a stadium deal? No, of course we haven't. So we're going to get one. And how are we going to broadcast it? And it's incredibly expensive to fly everybody in from Australia and New Zealand, but we haven't got any cameras of broadcast, international broadcast quality in the country.
Of course not.
So there's all this stuff that you've got to try. And we haven't got a training ground, and we haven't got a training pitch, and we haven't got, you know, we haven't got anything. That's it. The key's in the name, startup. So by the time I got there, and then COVID hit. Mm. And so, yeah, I've said this many times. I said this in an interview a few times today, but I'll repeat myself. When COVID hit, plans were very advanced.
Yeah.
And they faced a decision, which is, if you want to play this year, which was the 2022 season, you're going to have to relocate to Australia and play out of there. Because there's borders, no borders.
Right.
So no crossing the borders. Or something of that, whatever it was. Mm. I wasn't there, but, you know. So if they'd gone with their head, they'd have said, actually, we're okay, thanks. We'll wait a year until the borders open and we can play in Fiji, because the whole point of this startup is to have the team on the island. But they've been waiting 25 years for this. And they were, I think, underneath it all, frightened that the opportunity might be taken away again.
Yeah, I can completely see that.
So they took a big, deep breath and jumped off a cliff, and it nearly stymied them, if I'm looking back, because they played however many games it was in Australia. Nobody came to watch. They had no broadcast revenue. The cost base was enormous, and you pretty much chewed through the startup capital in the first 6 months.
Yeah, I can't see any. Yeah. So
however, at the end of that first season, for the last two inverted commas home games, the borders were lifted and they were played in Fiji. And the crowds were really strong, and the enthusiasm was really strong, and merch sales were really strong. Highest selling Super League jersey by a long, long.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We shipped 11, 12, 13,000 jerseys a season. That's a lot for a rugby club.
Yes, it is.
I tell you. Yeah. Yeah. We do, first three seasons, we've averaged about 12,000 jerseys.
Crazy.
So, you know, you walk around Fiji, everyone's in Drua. Everyone's in Drua again.
So, just on your players, I'm just thinking now, Melbourne Rebels, as an example.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are a couple of lads who grew up in Melbourne who were delighted to play for the Melbourne Rebels. You know, it was always their dream to play for a Melbourne team, but not really, you know. So they went and got, like, Danny Cipriani and Gareth Delve and some others, I guess. I mean, maybe my timeline's slightly off there, but that's what they did. Mm. I imagine that it was incredibly exciting for Fijian rugby players to have a team on Fiji. And just a follow-up question is that, when you were selecting players, did you have a certain type of player in mind? Was it people that had grown up on the island who were young and making their way, or was it getting the experience?
Well, again, I wasn't there for the selection of the first squad, although obviously there's not that many left from the very first iteration in 22. You know, rugby teams churn quite quickly.
Mm.
But look, they had to pick from players who were on the island because nobody was allowed in or out. And also we have self-imposed, because it's the nature of the franchise, we call it the project, and which is slightly pretentious, but we like it.
I like it.
And the project has a number of things that are over and above rugby. Okay, so you should dislike this.
I do already.
I don't think you will. So we're there to, first of all, we're there to provide a different on-island pathway for Fijian rugby players.
Okay.
So you don't have the island to be a professional player.
That sounds completely reasonable.
That's a big change. We're there to bring economic benefit to the island with visitor numbers and sports tourism and all the rest of it. We are there to make the country proud.
Mm-hmm.
We're there to support the national team in its World Cup campaigns particularly, and to provide a greater degree of cohesion, because more players playing in one team who then transfer, not all of them, but a significant number, into the national team must be helpful of performance. It's not. It's a model you're seeing around the world now. Chile has a very similar model. Georgia with Black Lion has a very similar model. Portugal with, I've forgotten their franchise team. I do apologize to my friends in Lisbon. They have the same model. The Netherlands with Delta have the same model. It's a decent model whereby you say, right, we're not a big country. Either we're not a big economic country, Fiji, or we're not a big rugby country, Netherlands.
Yeah.
The franchise, one team, concentrate your talent, get a high performance culture, create something that you play at a higher level. That's the hard bit in certain parts of the world. You know, the hard bit for us is to do that. We have to fly 4 hours minimum. You know, so it's challenging. But it does appear, and got to give World Rugby a lot of credit here. It's their model. They've driven it with a good deal of success in a number of markets. And I suppose us and Black Lion are their poster child.
Black Lion.
They put money in. They've stuck with it. You know, they've been investing in Fiji for quite a long time. They've taken quite a bit of hit from other countries saying you're giving too much to Fiji, you're giving too much to Georgia, to which their reply has always been, we don't want to be a mile wide and an inch deep. Yeah. We want to invest for a period of time so that we can drive these countries up to be competitive at World Cups. And one of the ways you do that, is to get your franchise team more competitive. And we are the franchise team. we're very independent. That was the other thing. Fiji has suffered over the years from a whole load of governance issues. So we have an independent board. Even though we're owned by the government and the union, they've signed pretty strong non-interference clauses in legal agreements. That's part of setting up a... That's another thing. If you're setting up a franchise... And, you know, to protect, to create the right governance structure, it sounds really, really dull, but it's incredibly important.
Yeah,
it's only been
yeah.
done that at the Premiership 25, 27 years ago. We'd be in a very different place.
So you started this by saying these are things that you're not going to like. These are all things that I absolutely love. These all make a lot of sense because they're all rugby-related goals.
I'm really glad that I can buy you into a purpose-driven organisation, well, JV. That's
even
what I'm say.
Surprisingly, Mark, I think you've actually missed. I think you've actually missed one.
Oh, I didn't give you all of them, but it would have gone on and on.
But like one of the obvious ones.
Well, for example, one of the big ones is we want to give job opportunities to native Fijians in the front, the back, and the playing department of the organisation.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
so we do want to, in a relatively short period of time, get the whole thing run by people from Fiji.
Yeah, I mean, it's a true economic development project, isn't it? And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean,
and we want players to earn decent money and. No, we'll never, I think we're realistic. We'll never match the salaries in Japan and France.
Mm.
But I think given another 5 years, and I think we'll be able to match, once you take the lower tax rate and cost of living into the equation, I don't think there'll be any monetary reason why a Fijian player should go to Australia or New Zealand.
The other, the thing I was going to say about the Drua project is, from an economic development point of view, it's bringing skills into the country. You see this a lot with like defense contractors, which is they want to win the work because then they have an indigenous skill. Now, it's not quite the same level, but it's things like you said, there weren't cameras on the island. Well, there are now.
No.
There are people that...
Broadcast's a great example.
Yeah.
And tell me to shut up because I can prattle on about this. I love it so much for hours. In the first two home games before I arrived, they were such a rush. They had to import everybody to do it.
And yeah.
It cost them, there were 24 expats flown in, accommodated,
Frankie.
God knows how much equipment. And if you'd had to do it for the whole season, it would have cost you something like $2 million Fijian dollars, right? Which is a lot of money for us. Next year, not this year, this year we're down to six. But next year, there won't be a single expat.
That's amazing.
On
that is genuinely amazing.
It will all be done by the Fijian broadcast company, who, to their credit, have invested several million Fijian dollars themselves in equipping, new cameras, training, etc., etc., etc. But now you've got capability on the island of producing international sports broadcasts to a level that's acceptable in Australia and New Zealand. And I think that is... That's something.
Absolutely right on that. Yeah, love that. You got me sidetracked now because I had another question for you. Yeah, merchandising, and we'll leave it after this one because we covered a lot of ground and we said 40 minutes to an hour, and I think we've probably exceeded an hour now.
Nearly, not quite.
We're not quite there. Well, we will be after this, I imagine.
Yes, okay.
Merchandising, like it's such a unique proposition what you have there.
Yeah.
It strikes me that merchandising will not just be something on the island, but something which you'll be exporting to, well, everyone, because that Fijian brand is so strong and the style of, well, style of play. That's not entirely true, is it? The perceived style style of play is so strong.
Yeah.
I can see that being a very, very popular thing to people in every rugby playing nation to wear that kit.
Well, we hope so. At the moment, you know, most of the stuff we do is aimed at Fiji. We have a big distribution arm with our partners at Jack's, who are one of the big stores here. We have a shop in the big tourist port of Denarau, which does good business. But really, merchandise is a function of your fan base on the whole. Yeah, some people buy it because they like the design or they think it's a cool piece of gear. But most people buy it because it's their team. Although my children say the Drua kit has done a wow in the five-a-side pitches of East London, but I haven't actually seen that myself. it's the fan base. I mean, our television audience is enormous. I think we think about one in two of the population watch the game live on free-to-air, which is an extraordinary stat. So if that was happening in Britain, that'd be 32 million people watching it.
That's amazing.
50% of whatever. And I don't think there's a country in the world that has that level of TV penetration, albeit, as we know, into a very small market.
Yeah.
Don't forget, a lot of our fans will never get to see us live because they live on one of the outer islands. It's too far. It's too expensive. They'll never, ever come. They'll never be. So it's really important we're on free-to-air. You know, it's again, part of the project. You can't claim to be the nation's team and then hide behind a paywall, particularly in a poor country like Fiji.
Do you have an online offering too? So can you stream the matches?
Yeah, you can. But to be fair, most people watch us on their phone.
Yep.
Data's really cheap here. And a lot of people don't have the internet on their... They don't have smartphones. They use their data to download and watch it live. So merchandise is really a function of that, if I'm honest. And people just seem to... I mean, that's the other thing I suppose I should say. It's not like lots of other markets. One of the first things when I came here, I couldn't get over, was you'd wander around one of the towns, which, you know, are interesting. And people are wearing rugby gear. You know, I'm looking at the rugby dungeon there on the Zoom with all your rugby. Very nice. I love to get Quinn's Etihad shirt. Well, that was a classic. That was an absolute classic.
It was a nice shirt. It is a nice shirt.
First ever sports sponsored by Etihad Airways in the UK, before Chelsea, before Man City. We were very proud of that one.
There you go.
They wear rugby shirts. That's what they wear. You wander around, you'll see NRL shirts, Premiership shirts, top 14 shirts, All Black shirts, Super Rugby shirts, and a pile of Drua shirts. But the business of sport is all about audience. It's the size and the income of the people who follow your game. And that's why, even though there's only a million people who live in the Fiji Islands, it's the number one sport by such a long way.
Yeah.
That that's just about big enough. And we come right back to the beginning when you asked about the startup. There's just about enough people and there's just about enough large businesses to generate enough revenue to be a competitive team in this market. And there's enough talent on the island to get a team that, you know, is pretty talented. And my final point is this about a startup franchise. Like all startup franchises, you've got to have a dream and you've got to have a vision and you've got to have an aim, an overarching. What are you trying to be and what are you trying to do? And, yeah, we have all these project stuff about opportunity and making the nation proud. And we believe it. We do. We live it and we believe it. But the other one is we want to win it.
Yeah.
We want to win in 5 years, and that is our that is stated in our strategic plan that we want to win Super Rugby within. This is year one. Now I sound like Steve Diamond. We want to win Super Rugby Pacific within 5 years.
Crikey, that would be quite something. Well, I think you put a lot of bits of the puzzle together there, Mark. I thought that was absolutely fascinating. So I think what we're going to do now is leave it there. I would politely ask that if you've enjoyed this and you've listened along with us to the very end, send us your feedback, contact eggchasers@gmail.com. We've still not really decided on a name for this. We've had some cracking suggestions though, Mark. Eggonomics would be one. I'll try to think
of the other one.
Do you?
I quite like that.
Economics.
Yeah, I do.
We'll think
I
of
do.
It. And we'll do a few more on the Egg Chasers feed before we move on to our own feed, I think. But yeah, that was absolutely fascinating. And we'll probably reconvene in a month's time. Do it monthly.
We'll have played a couple of games by then and I can update you. But it's
and you'll be stressed.
I should tell to our listeners, this is not going to be the Fijian Druid show, right? Okay, that was just... It just so happened... Talk about a startup. Well, all right, we'll do the Druid thing, but it's not, I promise, it's not going to be weekly Druid nausing stuff.
When our listeners are flooding us with emails, which undoubtedly they will do, they can give us suggestions for things that they want us to talk about because there is so much to talk about in the world of rugby and business, it's frightening.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.